you both about what you have said, Christoph, about Evan's detention. You said the U.S. journalist detained in Moscow is clearly a Russian state hostage. And then we're going to talk about what happened to you this week. You just came back from London, where you were denied a visit with WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, the WikiLeaks publisher who spent the last 4 years locked up at the Belmarsh High Security Prison in London while awaiting possible extradition to the United States, where he, like Evan, is being charged with espionage, but he faces 175 years in a U.S. prison. His crime? He released information about U.S. military in Iraq, in Afghanistan, State Department logs for decades. So start off with Evan and then move on to Julian Assange.
So Ivan is clearly a Russian state hostage, a sort of institutional hostage. If the Russian authorities would have a sort of good faith, they would have clearly exposed some elements about what they have. As you mentioned previously, according to the spokesperson of the Kremlin, he was arrested, he was caught red-handed. But after, what did we have? Nothing. We saw, and we could notice a lot of violations of the rights of defense, the legitimate rights that a suspect should enjoy. For instance, the media were prevented from entering the courtroom. His own lawyer could not enter the courtroom when the decision to put him in detention was made. And there are such elements, and also the lack of concrete evidences, that clearly show that the Russian authorities have bad faith, that they have taken him because he was reporting in a city with a military complex. And they said, this is spying. It consists in spying to just report, investigate in a city with a military plant. But if I have a look at what they officially said, the FSB said he went there, Ivan, to gather information about the Russian military industrial complex that constitutes a state secret. But that's legitimate for journalists to look for state secrets. It doesn't define spying. So clearly this is why we do defend Ivan, and clearly beyond his case. This is a way to intimidate journalists, foreign journalists in Russia, in the country. We know how Putin succeeded in the past decade, finalized it right after the beginning of the war, how he succeeded to extinguish, to re-suppress pluralism, independent journalism, to provoke an extinction in his own country. I mean about Russian journalism. But some foreign correspondents continue to work in Moscow and other cities. A lot of them left previously, as Ivan's friend mentioned, but some of them stayed. For instance, French correspondents are there. But now, clearly, what happened to Ivan is an intimidation for them.
So, Christoph, I wanted to go to you, actually, outside Belmarsh. You plan to be inside, but were denied. On Tuesday, your group, Reporters Without Borders, RSF, attempted to become the first NGO to visit Julian Assange since his arrest 4 years ago. Despite being given prior approval, you were denied entry. This is you outside the jail.
We take the opportunity of being here today, again, in front of this jail, to call on for his release. Julian Assange has made a very important, a crucial contribution to journalism. He made possible the revelations of war crimes. He should enjoy the First Amendment.
Joining Reporters Without Borders was Julian Assange's wife, Stella Morris, who also spoke outside the prison.
It is another instance of this completely unjustified interference with Julian's ability to try to conduct a political and also a legal defense against the U.S. outrageous U.S. case against him. It's the 4th of April today. Tomorrow will be 13 years since the release of the collateral murder video, revealing the killing of 12 civilians, including two Reuters Bureau workers. We are now about a week away from the four-year anniversary of Julian being inside Belmarsh prison. Julian's presence in this prison is a scandal. It is a scandal on every level. How is it that they can prevent him from meeting with the Secretary General and the Global Campaigns Director of Reporters Without Borders? This is a shameful act.
Christophe Deloire, if you could talk about that. You've said that this is only one of a series of obstacles that you've encountered right from the outset in dealing with this case. If you could explain what exactly has been happening and what you hope will happen now. Will you attempt another meeting soon?
So what happened is that in the past years, we requested to be able to visit Julian in his jail. We got an approval recently, which was confirmed on March 21st with a number, an official number, for myself and my colleague, Rebecca Vincent. And we were invited to come to the prison. And when we just arrived, the guy at the desk, when he saw my passport, he suddenly was very stressed. And I've taken a paper on his office, on his desk, and I've read it, saying, according to article, I do not remember the number of the article, but according to this article, you are not allowed to visit Julian Assange. This is a decision that has been made by the governor of the Belmarsh prison, based on intelligence that we had, I quote him, that you are journalists. And it doesn't make sense at all. First, because personally, I've been a journalist since 1996, and we were vetted, so it was never a mystery that I was a journalist, never a secret. Second, my colleague wasn't a journalist herself. So, we came here not as journalists, but as representatives of an international NGO with a consultative status in many international organizations. So it was really as reporters of borders representatives, not as reporters covering the case. So it doesn't make sense for this second reason, and there is a third reason for which it doesn't make sense, is that already two journalists, at least, have been able to visit him in jail in the past 4 years. So,
and very quickly, Christophe, we just have a minute, but Stella Morris, his wife, says his health is deteriorating inside. She was allowed to go in because she does visit him. Do you see parallels between Evan Gershkovich in Russia being held on espionage charges? They said he was trying to get military secrets from Russia. And Julian Assange, publishing U.S. military secrets, faces 175 years if extradited and found guilty in the United States.
I would not compare at all the U.S. and Russia. The U.S. are ranked 42nd in the World Press Freedom Index, Russia 155th out of 180 countries. One country has the worst records, some of the worst records regarding press freedom. The other one, the U.S., is defending press freedom all over the world. But what is clear is that the detention of Julian Assange for his contribution to journalism is clearly an inconsistency. And that really we call on the Biden administration and Joe Biden himself to stop this proceeding that was launched under the Trump administration so that the U.S. Clearly amplify their legitimacy to defend press freedom everywhere.
Christopher Deloire, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Christophe Deloire is the Secretary General, Director General of Reporters Without Borders, RSF, Chair of the Forum on Information and Democracy. Coming up, The Undertow, Scenes from a Slow Civil War. Stay with us.
Ooh, freedom, Oh, freedom. Oh, freedom over me. And before I'd be a slave, I'd be buried in my grave and go home to my Lord and be free. Everybody. Oh, freedom.
By Harry Belafonte, who our next guest writes about in his new book. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Perhaps the best day in history is what Donald Trump called his arraignment this week, when he became the first U.S. president ever charged with a crime. In a Truth Social post Wednesday night, he called those who indicted him radical left lunatics, maniacs, and perverts. This comes after Judge Juan Merchan, who's presiding over the case, asked Trump to tone down his attacks when Merchan and Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg and their families face multiple threats. Trump went after both the judge, the DA, their wives, the judge's daughter, as well the staffs are getting death threats. Well, our next guest spent the last decade reporting on how fascism has become a major threat in the United States and writes about it in his new book, The Undertow, Scenes from a Slow Civil War. Jeff Charlotte is an award-winning journalist and author, professor of English and creative writing at Dartmouth College, contributing editor at Vanity Fair magazine. His book debuted on the New York Times bestseller list, just three spots behind far-right Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, a possible Republican presidential challenger to Trump in 2024. Jeff, welcome back to Democracy Now! This is a powerful work. If you can put this aftermath of this historic moment, the first sitting or former president charged with a crime, in the context of the work you've been doing as you travel the country, speaking to people deeply involved with the far right, supporters of Donald Trump?
I think the indictment, the arrest of Donald Trump, which I believe was the right thing to do, is also, unfortunately, the fulfillment of something that's been coming for a long time. I think of the Trumpocene, a term I borrow from my friend Jeff Ruoff, a filmmaker, the Trumpocene, the age of Trump, in which his politics sort of defines a national conversation, as having three stages. One, the prosperity gospel, get rich. Two, a kind of dark conspiratorial kind of theology. But three, now, starting on January 6, 2021, the age of martyrs. And it began with Ashley Babbitt, the insurrectionist, who was killed at the Capitol and quickly became a martyr for the right. And I kind of think of her as holding a spot on the cross, a placeholder that Trump was keeping it warm until Trump could push her aside and heave himself up there. And that he's occupying the role of a martyr in the theology and the dream politic of fascism now.
So, Jeff, if you could talk about, first of all, explain the title of your book, The Undertow, Scenes from a Slow Civil War, why you believe there is a slow civil war ongoing, and whether you think this trial, in fact, as you've said, and we'll go back to Ashley Babbitt, whom you write about in the book, if you think this trial will exacerbate the fissures that you think are responsible for this slow civil war.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I've been reporting about right-wing movements around the United States, around the globe, for 20 years. And if you had asked me 10 years ago whether I thought civil war was possible in the United States, I would have said no, for all sorts of reasons. But what happened with the language that was always there at the fringe of the right. There was always that kind of radical civil war talk at the fringe. It started moving into the center. And then people who were at the fringe, like Marjorie Taylor Greene, carried it into the center with her language of the national divorce, and Trump himself with his civil war language. After January 6th, 2021, I noticed that a lot of American historians, folks who understand that history usually does move slowly, were saying we're closer to civil war than we have been in a long time. So I decided to start traveling the country, talking to folks. And one indicator to me is that when I didn't even have to say a question, I would just say civil war. And the answer from so many people was there were two answers. Yes, and they were looking forward to it, or yes, and it was a sad inevitability, but they expected it. I don't believe it is an inevitability at all, but I see people arming up. I see a steady drumbeat of what I think of as a slow civil war of violence, of pregnant people who are dying for lack of reproductive care. Those are casualties. Queer folks being criminalized in up to 20 states now, and all the kind of wreckage that comes from that, those are casualties. And really, we see on a weekly basis now armed men with AR-15s, Oath Keepers, Proud Boys, 3%ers outside hospitals, libraries, schools. So I think it's a simmering, and there's more violence going on now as I drove across the country, more guns than I've seen in 20 years of reporting. I think that it doesn't do us any good to say, could there be violence? Instead, we need to recognize that there is violence, and how are we going to respond?
So, Jeff, if you could now go back to Ashley Babbitt, the woman who was killed during the January 6th insurrection. As you point out, she used to be an Obama supporter. So first, explain how you can convey what is Trump's political ideology, and what did you understand from her about how she went from supporting Obama to becoming such an ardent enthusiast for Trump?
I think we can understand Trump's ideology. There's a short word for it, which is fascism. And really, in the classical sense, not in the way that we might want to describe various right-wing figures, but the cult of personality and the pleasure in violence, along with the sort of description of the rest of the world around him as decadent. I think, though, that the way we understand the undertow that pulls people like Ashley Babbitt or so many of the other figures I encountered in my travels into that sort of black hole of fascism is to recognize that it's not so much about any particular issue, but rather it is an aesthetic, as fascism is, but also a theology. And that's why I said the prosperity gospel it comes from evangelicalism, the idea that God wants you to be rich. And the way that you know that is because he's made your pastor so rich. Trump's golden plane is evidence of God's intention. The next stage of that, which I refer to as a kind of Americanized Gnostic gospel, a gospel of conspiracies, of secret initiates, and what Gnosticism calls waterless canals, but what Trump calls the deep state. This is sort of an appealing, the idea that you had this inside track of knowledge. And then we come to martyrdom, which, of course, we know has always had this kind of pull, the victimization of white grievance, which is the sort of the current that pulls white supremacy along.
Jeff Charlotte, I wanted to turn to the far-right Georgia Republican Congressmember Marjorie Taylor Greene, who was just in New York to rally for Donald Trump for a few minutes before he was arrested, where she was drowned out by whistles. But she was heard loud and clear this past Sunday in an interview that you were extremely critical of on CBS's 60 Minutes with Leslie Stahl. This is a clip.
The Democrats are a party of pedophiles.
I would definitely say so. They support grooming children.
They are not pedophiles. Why would you say that?
Democrats support, even Joe Biden, the president himself, supports children being sexualized and having transgender surgeries. Sexualizing children is what pedophiles do to children.
Wow. Okay.
That's Leslie Stahl saying, wow, okay, to Marjorie Taylor Greene. Jeff Charlotte, you tweeted, as a journalist with 20 years on the far right beat, I'm going to close read 60 Minutes MTG segment. To start, MTG, Marjorie Taylor Greene, is as famous as they get. That's their justification, fame, a.k.a. popularity, a.k.a. the fundamental currency of fascism, you said. And then you continue with 30 more tweets. Lay out your critique of this interview.
I think of the undertow as sort of my inquiry into how to tell stories about fascism, with the understanding that a lot of the ways that we've used in the past, they don't work anymore. They haven't worked. Leslie Stahl in 60 Minutes gave us a master class in how not to tell stories about fascism. In that clip that you show, that wow, the arched eyebrow, part of the problem is our I think Leslie Stahl's imagination that she still occupies the center, that she can dispatch that which she finds distasteful with an arched eyebrow. She's failed to recognize that Marjorie Taylor Greene is not a rising star in the old vernacular of politics because she's not trying to enter the same cosmos. They're trying to redesign the worldview to create a kind of, I think, of fascism as a kind of lucid dreaming in which you can make these seemingly absurd assertions. Leslie Stahl can't really contend with that using the frame that they have where we're going to have a polite conversation. And we're going to, she's going to rely on what she sees as the evident absurdity of that to debunk what Marjorie Taylor Greene is saying. I think, too, it's worth saying, just simply saying, but they are not pedophiles. This sexual mythology of the right now, it is a mythology. And I think to understand that you can't fact check a myth. The myth is not based on a claim to reality. Marjorie Taylor Greene knows that. She knows that her power is in spectacle, as fascism has always understood. It's an aesthetic politics. So what she did, and it really in some ways amounted to a defense of Marjorie Taylor Greene. When you show B-roll of Leslie Stahl strolling along with Marjorie Taylor Greene and marveling at her beautifully kept lawn, it's saying, oh, see, you thought this person was dangerous, but here I am walking safely along with them. Marjorie Taylor Greene is dangerous. We need to understand the danger. It's not that she's going to go feral and attack Leslie Stahl. It's that she's going to remake this country in a fascist image.
So, Jeff, if we could just go back. I'm sorry, I'm not sure you had an opportunity to answer the question about Ashley Babbitt and how she moved from supporting Obama to supporting Trump. And then also talk about, you say that the rise of fascism in the U.S. is part of a global fascist moment. If you could explain what you mean by that.
Yeah, that's sort of the microscope and the telescope. And Ashley Babbitt, and why I sort of focus so much on her story, is when I saw her killed on January 6, 2021, and it was a Capitol Police officer who shot her as she was climbing through the window, said to be that she was unarmed. She wasn't. She was carrying a knife. It's on the cover of the book. The officer was a black man, and as a student of American history and American mythology, I knew what the right would do with that right away. That's the old story. That's the lynching story. That's the justification. And they would take Ashley and they would age her backwards. They started saying she was 35. They say she's in her 20s. No, she's in her 16. They made her smaller, an innocent white girl. So I was interested in who was this person, really, and discovered that she joined the Air Force at 17, motivated by 9/11. She was two wars deep, you might say, two war generations deep. She served 8 deployments. Both theaters of combat, and she was a Democrat. She wasn't who we imagine. She modeled her life on the Coen Brothers movie, The Big Lebowski. She lived by the beach. And yet something about Trump in 2016, her first tweet on October, hashtag love Trump, gave her license to indulge in that which she'd been resisting her whole life. She was deep in debt by that point in her company. It gave her the license to say, instead of trying to be a better person, What if I indulge myself? What if I let myself go into this undertow, give in to the racist feelings I have in me? She lived close to the border, give in to the misogynist feelings. And it felt to her, she experienced it, she described it as a liberation. She felt free, giving in to her worst impulses. And I saw that play out again and again in the lives of people who you wouldn't expect. They weren't the usual suspects. You wouldn't suspect would be drawn into that undertow. And you said the global fascist moment. Yeah, I think it's worth understanding, because the temptation is a sort of the American exceptionalism of Trump, this sort of unique figure who was able to open the door to change that vernacular. And, you know, as Democracy Now! Does such a wonderful job doing, is there's fascism around, there always has been, but there has been around the globe now. So we have, you know, we have Erdogan in Turkey, the Trump of Turkey. We had recently the Trump of Brazil. There is a Buddhist monk in Myanmar who calls himself the Trump of Myanmar, who has led a kind of genocidal campaign. It is a global fascist moment that is coming out of all kinds of forces, of the failure of neoliberalism, of the pandemic. And I think to take it back to the intimate of these individual lives, of grief unprocessed, the grief at loss. She thinks her place as a white person is being lost. That's not a legitimate grief, but it's there. But also the grief of the pandemic, the grief of climate change. But she doesn't process it. She turns it into rage, and she calls that rage love. And that is what you see with all the January 6ers I spoke to, is driving them into the Capitol and driving them now out into a more dispersed kind of simmering conflict.
And of course, this week, the Hungarian prime minister, the far right, Orban, tweeted his support for President Trump. And you have Marjorie Taylor Greene comparing Trump being arrested to Nelson Mandela to Jesus. But Jesus. Finally, you start the book with Harry Belafonte. You end with the Weavers, of course, Pete Seeger apart. Why?
Partly because I couldn't stand to take my readers on this dark tour without some hope. But the hope I'm looking for is not the cheap grace of, we can do it. I spent a lot of time with the great Harry Belafonte, Lehi's, part of the Weavers. You know him from If I Had a Hammer and Kisses Sweeter Than Wine. You know Harry Belafonte from Deo, the Banana Boat song. I sang these songs in elementary school. I didn't know they were radical songs. I didn't know they were freedom songs. I wanted to understand the deeper struggle, the long struggle, to give us some hope. Because Harry Belafonte, in his 90s now, he's an angry man. He's still angry. He knows that the civil rights movement, in which he was absolutely instrumental, it did not succeed at nearly all that he hoped. The struggle is long. So what do you do, he says. He says, it's not so much where your anger comes from, it's what you do with it. And what do? You sing your song, and then you give it away. You take it from the top, and you keep singing. This is his call to an imagination, a thread of beauty that I try to run through this dark story, because I think if we're going to find our way through the Trumpocene, it's not going to be by returning to some normal that was never that great, but by following the model of these long ago singers, in many ways, unfortunately forgotten, but had a vision of a liberationist politics, which can meet fascism in a way that Chuck Schumer, say, cannot.
Jeff Charlotte, we want to thank you so much. The book, The Undertow. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
You're listening to Looking at Lyme on CJSF's Speak Up, and I'm your host, Sarah Cormode. Looking at Lyme is a podcast all about Lyme disease. My own journey back to health motivated me to understand the complexities of the illness, testing, diagnosis, and treatment. In each episode, you'll hear from experts in the field of medicine, science, and outdoor education. Together, we learn about topics such as neuroplasticity, pain management, co-infections, outdoor safety, and tick surveillance. You can find out more by visiting our website, lookingatlyme.ca, or following us on Twitter or Instagram. Tune in each Monday at 10 a.m. to hear new episodes.